This is November 16, 2008, and we're having our fourth session with Robert Carr, who presently lives in Mumbai, which for some people used to be called Bombay in India. So Robert is in our journey through his autobiography called God, Men, Con Men. He is at the point around 1960 when he's going to experience Krishnamurti for the first time in the flesh, and he has questions about the function of the center in Seattle. Go ahead, Robert.
Right. Well, for some time, since 1954, after reading Krishnamurti's First and Last Freedom, I became extremely interested in Krishnamurti. And to me, he was the only person that was giving a clear, detailed understanding of this process that people are interested in, this spiritual process. And I had rejected everything else, all the other systems of thought, ideas. On his word, I rejected them all and was very much involved with Krishnamurti. He was my hero. He was my one I wanted to be the most like. I wanted to be in that state that he was describing in his literature and talks and so forth. So in 1960... it was announced that he was going to be in Ojai giving some talks for the first time in a number of years, because he had been ill and he had been staying in Europe, and he was recovered enough to give some talks again in Ojai. So I and Connie contacted David Shreve and his wife Betty, and we made a journey to Ojai, and during the summertime, to listen to Krishnamurti. He only gave two talks, and he fell ill again and said that he couldn't continue, so he canceled the talks. So there was only two days that I heard him. The first day I was thrilled to be there in Ojai, somewhat uncomfortable with the role of being someone there to listen to him. That sort of bothered me to some degree. What he was saying was that you don't need a teacher, you don't need an authority. One has to do this on their own, and one has to discover this totally on their own. So it was a little bit uncomfortable being the disciple role, but at the same time I realized that what he was saying was very profound. And on the second talk day, he was talking, and he rambles, he starts out, he doesn't have any real beginning and end. He just starts talking, and it develops, and he continues. And as he was talking, and I was listening to him, I felt as if there was a ocean wave that had just come upon me, hit me, knocked me over, and when it receded, I felt that I was finished with the center in Seattle, with the role that I had been playing, with being a teacher of sorts, and I just felt relieved that this thing was finished for me. And I just felt cleansed, as it were. I didn't know what happened, how it happened, if anything did happen at all. Anyway, I then resolved, I said to Connie, I said, listen, after the talk, I said, listen, this center is finished for me. I'm going to close it up. And he agreed. We had a very good rapport. The truth is that we really don't communicate with people. Actually, we live our islands to ourselves. But Connie and I did have some kind of rapport connection, at least we felt that. So when I went back to Seattle, I had resolved then to bring about the closure of the center. And I wanted to do it in the most easiest way without hurting people's feelings and creating problems and so forth. So I called my friend Phyllis Goodall, who we'd often would have lunch together and discuss for a long time various aspects of our lives and living. We're very close to her. She was the lady who had been involved with Edgar Casey and knew him quite well. I told Phyllis that that for me the center was finished, was over. I couldn't continue anymore. And at first she was somewhat disturbed by this, but as we talked, she began to see that I was what I felt was right. I had to close this process that I was doing. I had to end it. I had to become free of the idea that I could help anyone or that anyone can be helped at all. I had to break that illusion for myself. I can't be helped by another, nor can I help anyone else. I had to be honest in that respect. And so I gave a talk at a park in West Seattle, and we had a picnic afterwards. And during that talk, I told my friend, my following, that I had come to the end of my tether with the center, and that I felt that the best thing to do was for us to close it and to pick up our lives and go on and sort out our own life and forget about belonging to any kind of group at all. It was detrimental to our own understanding. Of course, it's very involved in a philosophical way that the teacher exploits the following and the following exploits the teacher. It's a two-way thing that's going on. And when you see that, when it's very clear in your consciousness, then you can't operate that way anymore. It comes to an end. It just comes to an end. There's nothing you have to do about it. It isn't any act upon your part. Just the seeing of it makes it come to an end. Of course, this is the philosophy of Krishnamurti. He says that if you see something clearly, you don't have to do anything. It just, what happens is life just brings about the change that's necessary for you. And today, I can say that's how I operate all my life, during my life. I just try to see what's happening and then let life be the innovator that brings about the change. And it will. Life is cooperating in every way with us to bring about whatever it is that we're interested in experiencing.
Hold it, Robert. Hold it. You're giving a value there. You're teaching us something. You say that life works with us. So why are you going that far?
Because it's not what I do or can do, but it's, if you just become neutral and open and you say, okay, I'm finished with this situation, then you wait, just wait, and then you get a hint. Something happens. It just happens. All of a sudden you meet somebody, or this happens, and the door is open automatically for you. Okay?
Well, first of all, just step back from the mic a little bit. I think your mouth's too close to your mic or something. It's a little blurry. Okay. So, yeah, okay. So life unfolds within the moment, step by step, if you see as each reality appears and drop it and move on. But you don't have a big picture statement of what that means.
I never formulated it any other way. It's very simple. It's just a fact for me. And so then I met some Subud people in Vancouver, British Columbia. The man that brought the Subud so-called contact to the West, Mr. Bissing, I think, was an English fellow. And he had been initiated into Subud by Pak Subud in Indonesia. And I met him, and he wanted to know if I wanted to be open, and I said, well, let me think about it, you know, and I wasn't too interested. And Connie and I talked about it for a while, and in the next week or two. And, no, it wasn't Bissing, pardon me. There was a fellow in Vancouver named Joe Bissing, who was the contact after he received it from the man who came from Indonesia. And so we got in contact with him, and I thought, you know, maybe we should just see what all this is about. People were talking about it. And I said, I have a feeling that maybe we should let these people get involved with the center and maybe take it over. It would be a very smooth transition. I thought that. And so I invited Joe Bissing to come to Seattle, and he said, ask us if we wanted to be initiated. And we said, okay, we'll do this Subud thing. We'll find out what it is. So we experienced the Ladehan. And a few weeks later, got a little card in the mail from Pak Subud that we had been successfully opened, and we were now able to open others. And, you know, anyway, so I engineered with the full recognition that Subud wanted the center. It wasn't anything I was pushing on them. I offered it to them, and they said, yeah, they would take it over. So the Seattle group took the center off my hands. They bought the furniture that was there, and I got out of the lease, and I paid off all the bills, and Connie and I and Biff, the chimp, went to Oakland, California, to stay with Bob Thulman, who was a friend, who was had a TV show on Channel 2 in Oakland, the television station there. So that was the break. And my feeling was, okay, I just want to be Robert Carr, just Robert Carr, just not the spiritual man, not this, not that. Just, you know, I have to get a job and work and just be just your average normal guy in that respect. Just see what happens. And life moved on, and gradually, you know, I met Alan Watts and found him to be intriguing and very likable and a guy, and met him a number of times, had dinner and parties with him and so forth, went to his houseboat in Sausalito and listened to him talk and so forth. We became friends. And for years, I would see him off and on all the time. And I knew a lot of his friends. And I got a job, and I worked for an insurance company. Not in insurance, in the graphic arts. I put together their printing facility and managed it. Something I knew a little bit about printing because we had a press at the center in Seattle, and I knew how to operate it. And Connie got a job managing a grocery store in San Francisco, and we took a flat. And we were with David Wooster for a while. A number of us, and then it didn't work out too well, too many people. And so Connie and I found a little Victorian house in off of Geary Boulevard and took that. And I continued working, and gradually we developed a friendship with a lot of musicians and friends and artists. I met Wes Wilson. Wes and I became good friends. I left the insurance company because they moved to Pasadena, California, and I didn't want to shift there. I didn't want to leave San Francisco. And at that time, there was this hippie thing that was developing. You could the coffee houses were full of young people, and I noticed that a lot of people had long hair. Their hair was growing. They had you know, earrings, and they were very... they were dropping. They were taking LSD and experimenting with it, with drugs and so forth. And so, I had a number of pre-hippie friends. They were never beatniks, but they knew they were on the fringes of all this. Mostly, they were in the arts and the music world. And then, I got a letter from a lawyer in Seattle saying that Alice Taylor had died, and she was one of the ladies that had lived in the center, who was not a member, but just had rented a room there. And she had left Connie and I a sizable amount in her will, and that would be, the will was in probate, later on we would get some money. So we thought, well, when we get the money, why don't we close up this apartment here in San Francisco, get rid of everything, and go to Europe, hang out, and then go on to India. And while we were in Europe, we would listen to Krishnamurti because he was going to be in Sanand during the summer. I've been getting Krishnamurti mail from the Ojai Center. I kept in touch with what was going on. So I thought, well, this would be a month of Krishnamurti would be very interesting. Plus, it would be an experience of exploring Europe and so forth. And so, as time passed, eventually we notified that the money was ready. And so we sold everything. I sold almost all the furniture, the paintings that I had been doing. I did dabbling in art still. And we bought a ticket to Europe, Pan Am, and Connie and I left for Europe and traveled around the north of Europe, eventually going to Morocco.
In the okay, book Robert, let's, okay, Robert. Mm-hmm. Let's stop there. I go back a bit.
Okay.
Sure. This is going to. Scott, do you hear the echo? Scott's probably in the other room.
No, I do hear the echo, Bob.
You do hear it?
Yes.
Yeah, so how do we get rid of that? That'll be on the tape. Should we stop and reconnect? Or does that screw everything? I don't hear the echo now. It's gone.
It sounds okay now.
Okay. So, Robert, we're up to about April 66. You've covered 6 years. Now, I want to go back to the Ojai, California experience. In a way, seeing Krishnamurti in the flesh and him saying to you and to the group what you knew he would say, what you had read what he said, it was the actual, it was you wanting, you wanted to experience what you knew he would say, but in the flesh, and so you were ready to get the lesson from him. To really take it in.
Yeah, of course I knew all the words because I had read all his books. For years, I've been reading him, so I knew him, I knew lingo, you know. But the energy that's there in the flesh is quite different than what you read. So that energy was what I was interested in sensing and being aware of. And seeing him was, you know, was what I wanted. I wanted that experience.
You allowed yourself to experience the wave. Maybe in retrospect, since you're a bit skeptical of these experiences now, but you back then wanted to have this experience, had it with him, and said, "Yes, he's right. I will follow what he says. I don't need to teach people." And so it was an allowance of his vision that happened there. When you were meeting with Alan Watts, getting to know him, did you discuss Krishnamurti? I've heard Alan Watts have an opinion about Krishnamurti. What do you remember him saying?
Well, Alan, one time Alan said, if I ever have a problem, whatever it might be, he said, and I can't seem to get the answer to it, he said, I go to my library and I take any of Krishnamurti's books and read. A paragraph or two, he says, and then suddenly he said, I see my problem, and the answer, obvious answer is there. So he had a remark, he thought of him as a very remarkable individual. He knew him in Ojai. Alan was there for a short time and was flirting around with the Ojai school, the Happy Valley school. It didn't work out. Alan was a renegade, you know. He was an open, free spirit. And the Krishnamurti group are quite straight, you know, there's a certain nicety and goody-goodiness to them. They're the boring people, I find, you know. So they had no life. They just, you know, were following Krishnamurti to the letter. And having the school was a was a offshoot of the Krishnamurti teachings, the Happy Valley School. Actually, it was a school for rich parents' kids to go, so the parents didn't have to deal with the kids. They could put them there, a boarding school. So, and it happened in India, too. There are two schools in India. Both of them are full of rich kids whose parents, you know, just want to get rid of them, you know. Sorry.
But right, and the parents, in a way, respect Krishnamurti's teachings.
Well, some did, some didn't. Some of them didn't even know about him, you know. I remember Lana Turner had a daughter who was the one that did the stabbing, who stabbed Lana Turner's boyfriend.
Yeah.
She was a student there at the school, I believe. Anyway, it was full of rich kids, you know. Ojai is a very rich community there, and it's on the edge of L.A., and actors, kids, and film people's children went to school, to Krishnamurti School, because it was a avant-garde, something new, something different. I don't know how interested they were in Krishnamurti's ideas, I don't know, really. But okay.
Okay. I want to have another point about that. So that the school, did it offer a relatively Summerhill-like free curriculum, so it was a little more relaxed than your regular school, and the rich people liked
it? Yeah,
that?
And the teachers had there was less students, so there was more contact. And they tried to bring about, you know, awareness that there was something in life more than just what the average people think that's going on. The Krishnamurti School tried to emphasize freedom from belonging to a religion, belonging to a group, ethnic group, or this group or that group. It tried to initiate an interest in the mystical kind of evaluation of what life is. I don't think that it has succeeded in that way at all. I think it's made a lot of misfits.
Yeah, you've mentioned that to me, that the kids you know that went to school didn't turn out too great.
No, they're all frustrated. Yeah. Even the ones in India.
Why do you think that is?
You have to fit into the system that you're brought up in. You can't. In America, you have a better chance to succeed. But in places like India, Asian countries with a long ancient tradition of family, of the family being the center of your life, if you break away from that and try to live separate from that, you're going to be excommunicated from the family, which means no money. Right?
Yeah.
And so the kids are frustrated. Because they know if they follow the Krishnamurti line, they might. One little boy said, "Sir, I'll end up a street cleaner if I have to go to school and be an engineer, because that's what my papa wants me to do, you know, and I can earn money with a degree in engineering. But if I follow, you know, you sit very straight." Look at the sunset, feel the breeze. You know, this isn't going to make money for me. I was amazed. Yeah.
Well, how did Krishnamurti respond?
Oh, too much, he said. You're too much, he said. But he knew that the problem of Indian culture, how it is the source, families. Centered, and he says this is the most destructive thing in your existence is belonging to an idea. Belonging to a family is no different than belonging to a religion or to a political party or whatever. Being a hippie or not hippie or a Nazi or you know, if you belong to something, you're dead.
It's interesting. Yeah, Do you see that tradition in India being weakened right now with the digital life that's coming to them, that finally it's cracking and their kids are in even more trouble?
In the big cities, like Delhi, Bombay, and,
Because you
by
could,
the way,
you could,
by the way, people who have lived in Bombay for 40, 50 years, born here, they call it Bombay today. They don't say Mumbai. Mumbai was a political move by some politicians who wanted to make a name for themselves, take a name, a great name like Bombay, and change it to Mumbai. It was named after the goddess Mumba Devi, who was a patron goddess in the island. Bombay was a series of islands, and the British filled it in and made a city out of it. And today it's all fill. I'm living on an ancient riverbed, I found out, in Taku Village, which is outskirts of Bombay. It's about an hour to the center of the city. Not the center, but the old part that the British built, which is very charming and still has that flavor of what people expect when they think of Bombay. Old buildings, you know, wide streets, you know, shops.
Okay. Right. Now, Robert, when you're talking
about... The suburbs are horrible. The suburbs are horrible. They're malls and
Do they have gated communities?
Yeah, I live in a gated community now, so...
Okay. When you talk about the conservative nature of the Indian kids or whatever, the Indian mindset, I look at porn on the web occasionally, and I look at, they show different cultures. I mean, everybody posts. Mm-hmm. Everybody's out there screwing, and they're posting their amateur videos on there on the internet. And the other day I was watching a young Indian girl, Asian Indian, and she was very passive and hardly moving, but getting aroused as the guy, you know, chewed her out. And I was struck by that is what Robert, because you have mentioned this to me before in some way. I said, that's what Robert's talking about. I can see the puritanist in the young girl. I don't know if all Indian girls are like this, but this one really stood out for me as the archetype.
She's behaving, she's behaving the way that she thinks that she's been taught to behave by her mother and grandmother and the family. You know?
Yeah, I could see
But the
that.
Indians are horny. The Indians are horny. There's a billion of them here. And how did the billion arrive? It didn't come from the stork, you know?
Well, Andy Warhol said that frigid people were better lays. You know, they... better fucks, better lays, you know, better sexual experiences. No, because they... I don't know, they're more pent up, they're more explosive, but this Indian girl wasn't exploding yet, you know. She was very passive, very, very sensual in a way, but not like the regular porn people who are just leaping all over the place, right? Bouncing off
the bed. Yeah, the Bollywood movies are interesting. They have the sexiest girls wearing the least amount of costume, clothing, and hunk men, and they're all gyrating their hips in unison together as if they're fucking or something. This all goes on in the Bollywood movie, but they never kiss.
Wow. And they don't show naked sexual stuff.
No butts or tits or asses. You know. Just come out now. There's a movie now with John Abrams where he says he shows his butt. So this is a big thing now. he's a super hunk, you know.
John Abrams, he's a super Indian actor? Okay.
Yeah, hunk. Yeah, he's a hunk.
Oh, okay. So, okay, that's an interesting digression. Now back to when you're with Alan Watts, he comments on Krishnamurti as still a mentor for him at that point.
Yeah.
When also your printing led to you meeting Wes Wilson and him, you gave him his first acid trip, and Wes Wilson basically was one of the first creators of psychedelic posters, right?
Yeah, I think maybe, you know, like, no one can say for sure, like, you know, like, when I think about the light shows, you know, it was a spontaneous combustion, so there were people all over the country doing it at the same time. So no one, there wasn't any one person that started it. Although there was a center light sound. No, it wasn't that. There was a San Francisco Tape Center, it was called. They did electronic music, and they had. I used to go there. It was on Divisadero Street. It was a thing to do if you were hip. And I listened to the electronic music, and they had the beginning of the light shows then. And I thought, what are they doing? And they had liquid projections, you know, clock faces they were using on overhead projectors. It was very crude, very simple, but it was the beginning of it. And that was before the Avalon and the Fillmore Ballroom and so forth going on.
So, well, Robert, you just oh, we got the echo again. Let me just get the echo. Maybe Scott can. Okay.
I don't hear it at my end.
Okay, I hear it at my end, but I think... Okay, it's gone now. Okay, Robert, you hit the synchronicity. The mm-hmm. Tape Center, we have mentioned Gerd Stern to you before.
Mm-hmm,
Gerd
right.
Stern, we've just interviewed for throughout the summer for 23, 24 hours. Now, he... Yeah. He created that performance in November 63, and he used a young man, Michael Callahan or Kavanaugh, I keep forgetting, Michael Callahan, let's say, was a young employee of the Tape Center, and Pauline Oliveros, I don't know if you remember that name, and Morton Subotnick. Those were the two. Sounds familiar?
Yeah, that sounds familiar a little bit.
Yeah, that Tape Center provided young Michael Callahan to work the electronics for Gerd's show, which was done, I think, on mm-hmm. November 18th at the, I don't know if it was at the San Francisco Museum, but it caused a sensation. It was made up of these different tables, and he had famous San Francisco media personalities from Allen Ginsberg to editors of newspapers speaking in little panels around microphones while there was a larger panel of sociologists taking questions. And they wired it up, and the feedback got out of control. And it just became a crazy event, and Gerd and his friend, I think it was Michael McClure, took the beatnik poet, playwright, they took acid and then experienced the rest of the evening on acid. So it got a terrible review the next day, but that review led to lineups the next night, the next mm-hmm. couple of days. And do you think you were at that show?
Well, I didn't go to that specific one, no. I don't remember that, but I remember going there and checking out the Tape Center there, listening to electronic music. Because I was a little bit, Edgar Varese that you mentioned, I had his records, and I was interested in anything that was different, anything that was way out, man, you know. And,
right.
And that was very close to where I lived.
Right, no, so Gerd was the first. He and Michael Callahan and some others started the light show effect mm-hmm. world in New York in 64-65. They leave San Francisco and go back. Now you're to start the Retina Circus about 3 years later, 67, but mm-hmm. Gerd followed a parallel track like you would in various multimedia endeavors. But it's interesting that you knew the Tape Center, and so probably Gerd and a few people did some things after the show I'm talking about in November 63. Now, the Kennedy assassination happens around there. Were you affected in any way by that?
Yeah, I think everybody was. You know, it was shock. You know, I remember I was working, and my boss came over and said the president had just been shot, and then he said we're closing the office, and we're all in shock. You know, because Kennedy had such a charisma. You know, in spite of what he did or not did, you know, what he didn't do and all this, and the politics involved with his family, he did have a charismatic effect on people, and it was sad, you know, event. And I remember going home and being, I'll tell you what it did, it made one sense their own vulnerability, that this could happen, you know, your own mortality is play there.
So it's a spiritual event. from your perspective, it helped everybody confront their nothingness.
Well, I guess so, yeah. Yeah, because I interpreted everything in that kind of way. That was my, I was a philosopher, you know, a philosopher of sorts. So I saw everything in a philosophical way, and not in an actual way, but in this interpretive religious way. It took some time to cut that out of me, you know. It's still there, lurking in the corners of my consciousness, and will always be there. It's in the world consciousness. But if I look at something closely, then I free myself from the religious, you know, symbolism that's there.
Right. Now, Wes took LSD and that affected him, and he made the he used your printing press or printing company or something to make some of his first posters? Is that what happened there? Well, or he made a birthday card?
I met Wes, and he was very, you know, I liked him immensely. He was a friend of Kent Chapman, a friend of mine who was in my Vedanta days in Portland, Oregon. And Kent was now living in San Francisco, and they were living in a hotel called Wentley Arms on Polk Street, which was notorious as being a hippie pad, very cheap. Some of the doors didn't even lock. You couldn't lock your doors. And artists and the new hippie types were living there. Wes was living there, and Kent introduced me to him because I can't live there. And at that time, Kent was dabbling in art, and he was also hooked on methadrine. He had been in the army, and was in the Korean War, and the army gave him methadrine because he was a dropout and a failure. And he got hooked on methadrine, so that became his god, drug of choice. And so I met Wes. And I liked him. I really liked him immensely. I could see he was, you know, something was there bubbling inside of him. He said, "I want to be an architect, I think." And I thought, "No, not an architect. There's something else is there." So as we got to know each other more, I said to Wes, I said, "How would you like to try taking this LSD?" Because Kent had talked to him about it. And he said, "Yeah, I would like to." So he came over to my house on Geary Street. It was an apartment house on the second floor of the building above the American Terrazzo Center. And I gave Wes his first LSD trip, and his girlfriend was there, but she didn't take it. She just wanted to, she was a little apprehensive about it, and she just stayed there and during the trip. But I kind of engineered his trip and with music and headphones and lying on the floor and directing him in this way and that way. And he had a very artistic, profound, you know, mystical, beautiful experience with LSD. And after I thought that he was stable enough to go home, I told him, "Okay, you want to leave or go home and enjoy the rest of what's there and between yourselves." So then after that, Wes became very close to me, and we said, "Look, I was leaving the insurance company. They were shifting to Pasadena, as I said, and so I said, well, why don't I just open my own little shop?" So I asked Wes, "Would you like to join me? Because it's more than a one man operation; it's at least two men." So he said, "Yeah." So we opened the first printing shop. We called it Contact Printing, and Wes was my partner. And Wes was going to have a wedding? I think a wedding announcement or something. Well, he was asked to do a poster for a nightclub that was in San Francisco that was having the new rock groups that were forming were playing there. And Bill Graham was I think he was managing the club there. Anyway, they wanted a poster of some kind made, announcement, and we were the hip poster people or printing people, so Wes designed the first kind of poster, and we printed it. And that started the new wave. And eventually Bill Graham and opened the Fillmore, and the Avalon Ball was opened by Chet Helms. I met Chet earlier. Chet was my main man. He used to get grass for me when I wanted it. And so when Chet opened the Avalon, they needed a poster, so they came to us, and we did the first poster. And then other artists started coming into it. Within a very short time, the thing just exploded, you know, in San Francisco. And the Fillmore and the Avalon were running, and there were five or six poster artists that were making the posters. Lux Goso, Kelly and Mouse, and Rick, well, I can't remember his last name now.
Griffin.
And Wes Wilson.
Rick Griffin, yeah, or Rick Griffin?
Yeah, Griffin, yeah.
And okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay, just finish your last sentence. What were you going to say?
Well, Wes was kind of I think he did maybe more posters because he started making posters for Bill Graham. He did the 80 or 90 posters for Graham before he left him. Moscoso and the others came a little bit later, there were just two events a week, so there was, you know, 10 poster artists, so they had to divide it up, sort of. But Wes was making one every week for Graham. It's like he had a contract. And Graham was not paying him the proper amount of money for the posters. Graham was selling them after, he would print so many that were in storefronts and all around the avenues. And then Graham was printing 5,000 and selling them to shops that were springing up all over, both in Portland and in San Francisco, but in New York also. And he was not, Wes wasn't getting any money. You know, it was a real ripoff. Graham was a real jerk, you know, greedy bastard.
Interesting.
Anyway.
I'll read what you say on page 96 of your book. You say, our hope was not only to print art posters and accept interesting jobs, but also to make a living and pay for the new equipment we had purchased that did every kind of printing. Somehow we made a living. For about a year we worked hard and kept late hours. Wes and Eva decided to get married. Wes designed his own wedding invitation. It was based on what he saw the day he took the LSD. I think this was one of the first works of psychedelic art in San Francisco. Later, we designed and print the first rock posters for the Fillmore Dance Concerts in 1966. Wes suddenly began to be famous. His art was in demand. He had a new career. Are you saying then he never did get a lot of money for his posters, or eventually he did?
No. I think Graham used to pay him $100 for the poster design. And that was it. And Graham was selling 5,000 of them for $1 apiece. You know.
And Wes didn't know that?
Wes knew it, but he couldn't. Bill Graham was a fortress.
Yeah.
You couldn't make a dent in him. He was a super businessman, and, you know. So.
I mean, that's pretty bad. You're selling somebody's work, and you don't even give them a token contribution.
Oh,
I mean, that.
Eventually, he gave him something. Not much. Very little. It was only that when Wes broke away from Graham that he started doing other things for advertising agencies, and he did something for Time Magazine, and he was starting to branch out in other fields where he could charge the right kind of fee and so forth.
And he did okay on that? Did you keep in touch with him?
Okay. After I came back from India, he was still with Graham, and it was then that he broke away. I think Connie and I had some effect on him. In fact, Connie had a fight with Bill Graham in the Fillmore Auditorium. We went to see him with Carlo Shapiro, who was an attorney, famous attorney in San Francisco that he used to represent the downtrodden and all the people on the fringe. And we tried to reason with Graham. And he wouldn't even reason with us. And finally, Connie yelled at Graham, and Graham punched Connie and hit him in the jaw. And then we all grabbed Connie because he started to go after Graham. And then we said, Carl said, this is enough, forget it, and we left. and were disgusted, you know. The Graham would resort to fisticuffs, you know. So we Carl said, but don't you have a record of the sales, you know, because we're trying to get the back money for us. And Graham said, look, the money goes in the right pocket, and I pay out of the left pocket. That's all, you know. Even his own wife, a girl named Bonnie, he was exploiting her. She was making posters, too. And she wasn't very good. She was not really an artist, you know. She was... But anyway, you know.
He was exploiting her by just getting her to do it or using...
getting her to do them. Yeah, you know.
And
Chet Helms was the only one that was really up front with the poster artist, but he was such a such a bad businessman. He gave everything away, basically.
Chet Helms, I've read some different histories of that period, and I remember one person saying the first long-haired hippie in San Francisco was Chet Helms.
Maybe.
Yeah, about 1963 or something, he showed up in San Francisco and it looked very bizarre, this man with long hair.
Yeah.
And you knew him around that time.
Yeah, I met him, yeah. Mm-hmm. He used to come over to where I lived, and I met him. We used to have Sunday soirees, music, jazz concerts in our flat. It had a big, big living room, and we had a piano, and so... A lot of musicians used to come fall by, and they would jam all Sunday afternoon. And people would drop by, and various posters. A lot of artists were there, and that's how I met a lot of people, and so forth. And I could see something was happening, but it hadn't happened yet, you know. The first big event was called the Trips Festival. You know about that?
Well, I guess you mean Ken Kesey's stuff.
Yeah. Well, he was one of the parts of it. It wasn't just Ken Kesey. It was actually Bill Graham. I think he was hired to oversee getting it together, getting the bands together, and so forth. It was a 3-night event at the Longshoreman Hall, you know, in North Beach in San Francisco, and I went every night. And Sandy Jacobs was there. He was doing an event. Ken Kesey was there. I Love American. I Love Indians with the guy who did the Whole Earth poster.
Stuart Brand
was there. And the great.
Let me interrupt there. Robert, let me interrupt. Now, we're talking about Gerd Stern. Gerd Stern was involved with Sandy Jacobs since the 50s at KPFK. He had a whole personal involvement with Jacobs. Stuart Brand got his start and launch from Gerd Stern. So you see the Gerd Stern overlap here in your life.
Innovator.
Who, Gerd or Stuart?
Yeah.
Oh, no, who? Gerd? Both of them, right.
Gerd first. He turned Stuart on. Stuart had the know-how to get things done. You know, he was very, very, very clever in that way.
So, yeah, he'd been in the Army, so he had maybe some discipline.
Yeah. But after the Trips Festival, I left for Europe and then later India. So.
Okay, I'm just looking up... on Wikipedia, Trips Festival, and it says January 66, so that's just before you left. Yeah, right. It says Longshoreman's Hall. You got a poster here. Do you think that was designed by West, the poster?
Yeah, we did the poster, yeah.
Yeah, 400 North Point on Longshoreman's Hall. January 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 3 days.
Three nights.
That would be...
That was the beginning. That was the first rock kind of, you know, acid trip, you know, with the light shows and rock music. And I think the Loading Zone was there, and Grateful Dead was, they called themselves the Merry Pranksters, I think, at that time. And they were awful, but anyway, people liked it.
They were awful in what way?
as musicians.
Oh, okay, right. But the I was going to say this would be just a week before your 38th birthday.
Right.
You would have been 38, almost 40, witnessing this, and and you're watching. These are artists. These people are in their 20s, maybe not college kids yet, right?
Yeah, they're all in there. Yeah, just over the cup. Yeah,
in the late 20s, but older than college kids, maybe.
Yeah, 20, 21, too. Yeah, something like that.
Oh, okay.
Some of them dropped out of college.
But you're considerably older than them.
Yeah.
Now, there was another point. I wanted to just point to you that Chet Helms, I don't know if you know this, he died in 2005.
Yeah, I knew that, yeah.
Yeah, he was born in 1942, so he's, 14 years younger than you. And yet, you know, these people are your friends, but they're kids.
All my friends were young, and even today, all my friends in India here are under 30 years old, basically, except for a couple of Mahesh Bhatt and a couple of other ex-Rajneeshis who are fell under the charm of Yuji, and a writer I know. I was at his home last night, had dinner with Arun Babanis, who's a writer, and his wife. They were members of the Rajneesh community, the Osho community. But they got wised up and saw the light, so to speak. So
saw
all my
not.
Friends are like, so are 25, 23, 26 years old, so even today. So,
Well, Dave Worster's like that, too. He has younger people around. Okay, but back to Chet Helms. This, they call him, now, okay, we're talking about how you're older, but you're in touch with the young kids. You've always been that. I wanted to ask you 20 minutes ago, are you and Connie sampling other lovers in the gay scene in the early 60s, or are you loyal, almost married, during this period?
Well, we were very loyal to each other as a companionship and friendship, but we had loosened up and were having other brief encounters, affairs, on our own. Yeah.
And this would be when you're working for the insurance
company. We were very close.
But this was when you were working for the insurance company before the printing press.
And
the thing is that because you're out cruising, that's why you're in touch with arts and movements and scenes and that. If you're out there, you'll meet people.
Could you hang on a second? My phone's ringing.
Okay, Robert, it says here in the Wikipedia, Chet Helms, often called the father of San Francisco's 1967 Summer of Love, was a music promoter and a cultural figure in San Francisco during its hippie period in the late 60s. He was the founder and manager of Big Brother and the Holding Company and recruited Janis Joplin as its lead singer. He was a producer and organizer. Did you ever meet Janis Joplin?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I met her, actually, in the Anxious Asp, a bar in North Beach, when she was a folk singer, before she developed her raspy voice. She was a friend of Kent. That was back in '63 or something like that.
She was a friend of who?
I don't remember.
Who was your friend of?
Kent Chapman, my friend.
Kent Chapman?
Kent, yeah.
Okay,
she was a regular at the Anxious Asp, which was this funny little bar. It's in North Beach.
Would that be a gay bar, or?
Yeah, I think it was a girl gay bar, a lesbian bar. Anxious Asp.
Okay.
It was.
It said. Okay.
Well, no, I'm not sure. It was a mixed group.
What?
Mixed group.
Right.
It was a mixed group.
Yeah, bisexual.
Well, people didn't call it that.
Yeah. Okay, so it says, Chet was a producer and organizer, helping to stage free concerts and other cultural events at Golden Gate Park, the backdrop of San Francisco's Summer of Love in 67, as well as other venues, including the Avalon Ballroom. He was the first producer of psychedelic light show concerts at the Fillmore in Avalon. So was he influenced by what you guys put on?
Well, I gave Chad Helms a light box, which was a kind of a light show box that I had, that I was given to me by a friend from Seattle, Washington. And I gave it to him before I left for India or Europe. We used to do little light shows in my flat. We had a little mini light show device. And you know, when you take LSD, suddenly all the lights and things take on new meaning to you. So, you know, I was experimenting with crystals and projecting light and slides and mirrors and things like that. So I had a little mini light show that we used to watch in different colors and so forth. Now it would be very boring, you know. But it's interesting right now. On television here in India,
yeah,
they're doing all the light shows. You know, behind everything, there's a light show going on. And it's too much, in fact. It's overboard. But I look at it and say, gee, you know, this is the things we were innovating and doing, you know, 20, 30 years ago, you know. So.
And this, 2 points. First off, this is India going through the 60s, so to speak?
Well, American television has it too, you know. Behind a band, there's always a lot of lights and images.
Okay.
So you would
say you got the idea of psychedelic mixed media from Garrard's Tape Center. You would acknowledge that?
I was aware that they had these liquid projections, you know. They were very simple, very simple, you know. Dyes sliding around in a glass, you know, projected on the wall, you know. But it was the beginning of it.
So you got the idea from going to the tape center, or you got it on your own?
Well, when I came back from India, I went to the Avalon Ballroom and I saw my first light show, you know, that was going on. And when Connie and I were traveling, we were thinking when we came back to America, we would continue our interest in film production and develop and do some films. Because I did a short film before I left for Europe for a fellow in San Francisco. So that was my interest. And we had a 16mm camera that we were toting around with us in Europe and India, shooting what we thought was interesting and so forth. But I wanted to get involved in the mixed media. And so when I saw the light shows, I said, oh yeah, this is interesting, this is it. But you know, I said, it needs to be improved. Vastly improved, I said to Connie. It needs to be cleaned up. Get all the rough edges out of it. So we decided then to make our own light show with Bill Duncan, a friend that had worked on a movie with me in San Francisco. He was the cameraman. And so Bill, Connie, and I, we started creating the first our light show, and we decided to make it different than what the other light shows were. We went to see Bill Hamm's light show, which was very good, very, very good. And we saw Headlights, Jerry Abrams, and Glenn, what's his name? Anyway, we saw the best light shows, we thought, that were said to be the best, and we said, no, we can do better than this, we thought. We were arrogant, but you have to be arrogant if you're going to succeed, you know?
So, right, and you did, we'll get into that, you do create a successful light show and get attention up in Seattle. But back to, Garrard Stern talks about they did electronic mixed media. They didn't do the liquid in the bowls. The mixed media idea probably came from the tape center for you. You probably could say that, but you didn't implement it till later. Later. But I wondered, there was another idea in there. Let me just think.
I think I only went there once, maybe twice, you know, to two concerts. So once I went there, I said, okay, this is what they're doing. Okay, it's great, different, you know, but I got it, so I didn't go back. You know?
Let me read you, this is a guy named, what was the name of the filmmaker you made the film with before he went away? I was wondering if it's someone I've heard of.
Ben Van Meter. Ben Van Meter.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of that name somewhere.
Yeah, Ben was a filmmaker, and he did a lot of films during the hippie period, and all experimental films. He didn't have a light show, Ben, I don't think. No, he didn't. But he might have contributed films to the light show people. We were getting films from all different sources. People would lay films on us and that they had made, and we'd copy them and give the films back and say thank you, and we'd use them in our light show.
Because would these names seem... What about Jordan Belson, I think his name was? He kind of made the first computerized... Do you remember those films?
Yeah,
Jordan Belson, Stan Brackage, Stan Vanderbeek.
Made some very far-out films.
Who did?
Belson.
Jordan, yeah. You were aware of that stuff in the early 60s in San Francisco. Okay, there's a guy named Charles Perry who's written this book, A History of the Haight-Ashbury. Now, I just want to read the first couple of paragraphs, see what it triggers in your memory. And so he's talking about New Year's Eve 1965, going into 66. On New Year's Eve, Stuart Brand and some associates staged a parade down Montgomery Street, the heart of San Francisco's financial district. Office workers were celebrating with the traditional ritual of shredding the past year's calendars and throwing the paper out the windows. The paraders, Stuart and them, told the bankers and secretaries that as they passed them in the street, quote, "What you are doing is beautiful. Realize that you're in a parade and you'll be as beautiful as what you do." End of quote from Stuart and them to the bankers and their secretaries. Then it says, the real reason for the parade was to get a little press attention for an event 3 weeks in the future, a sort of circus that would gather together the acid test, the open theater, tape music center activities, rock bands, light shows, and everything else the organizers could think of. Stuart Brand and his friends were going to use Longshoreman's Hall and have Bill Graham coordinate it. The name was straightforward, the Trips Festival. Now that would have been 2 years after GERD's performance at the San Francisco Museum. Yeah. Anyways, it says there was another small test on New Year's Day at Sound City, a San Francisco recording studio where the events were recorded to be released as an album. For January 8th, that test, they planned a bigger test than ever before. They had the Fillmore Auditorium with more electronic equipment than ever, since Owsley Stanley had turned his perfectionist attentions to the sound equipment being used by the dead. He'd bought cratefuls of amplifiers and speakers and monitors and even an oscilloscope. This time, the pranksters had closed-circuit TV portapacks to add to the instantaneity. Ron Boise bought a lot of thunder sculptures for this event, including one shaped like a vulture, another shaped like a seashell that you could crawl into and get lost in, and then something called the Tuned Woman. The Tuned Woman. The Fillmore was basically a huge dance floor with a balcony running along two walls. The balcony was subdivided into dressing rooms and offices, so the pranksters were able to wire the place up with microphones and speakers in unexpected places, so you might be downstairs watching somebody make a fool of himself on the closed-circuit TV and suddenly hear something you'd said upstairs a few minutes ago broadcast all over the hall. The floor was littered with electronic boxes and skeins of electrical cable. They had packed in so much electronic equipment, the whole hall had a low, dull buzzing sound. On one of the balconies, Stuart Brand found Neil Cassidy in an unusual pose, standing still and watching. Not jerking around, not running his mouth. You know, this is the famous beatnik, Neil Cassidy, right? Yeah. Not tossing his biceps exercise hammer. He was gazing down at the seafloor, a riot of blinking electronic equipment, stone people reeling around blowing whistles, counting their toes, looking for their lost minds in the thunder machines. Two electrified guitar bands were playing at cross purposes. Slides and swirls of color were being projected on the walls, as well as sometimes what seemed to be snatches of a Kesey novel in progress, unless this whole event was a Kesey novel in progress. Cassidy looked serene and meditative. He said placidly, "It looks like the publicity for your Trips Festival is going pretty well." Then it says, publicity for the Trips Festival, which had now hired an advertising agency, was going full blast. With full McLuhanite confidence in the world historical force they represented, Stuart Brand and Company took posters and leaflets advertising their event to the posh Mark Hopkins Hotel on Nob Hill. Trips Festival? They were directed to the travel desk. Lou Gottlieb, a folk singer whose highly successful group, The Limelighters, had disbanded 2.5 years before, had just started, and he had started writing a music column for the San Francisco Chronicle. Stuart Brand and Raymond Sender of the Tape Center and Ben Jacopetti of Open Theater went to talk to him about a write-up. His column appeared on Tuesday. So it goes into that. Does that trigger any stories or names?
No, I don't have any...
You weren't aware of the publicity. You just went to it.
Yeah, I just went to the... I wasn't involved in the mechanics of any of it. I had the printing company, and that was taking my time, you know, so forth.
Right. It says here... let's see. The judge had warned Kesey specifically not to go to the Trips Festival. So I guess Kesey was in trouble by then. And
yeah, he was already in trouble.
Right, it said, too bad. Kesey and his friends took their garish bus directly from the courtroom to downtown Union Square to publicize the Trips Festival, so they ignored the judge. They had paraded around in prankster costumes, which had come to look like Marvel Comics superhero suits. Kesey in white jeans with the word hot printed on one buttock, cold on the other, and Tibet in the middle. They spoke to the press, set up and played a thunder machine, and unloosed two balloons carrying a sign and printed with the word now that ascended beautifully until snagged on an airline sign on an office building. Stuart Brand was worried that this publicity front page news from rooftop bus to balloon ascent might jeopardize the Trips Festival's use of Longshoremen's Hall. They had been promoting the event as a non-drug recreation of a psychedelic experience. A McLuhanite Global Village electronic art happening. On the handbills, they had suavely defined a trip as an electronic experience.
They had a wash tub of Kool-Aid at the Trips Festival, and Ken Kesey was, they were loudspeakers blasting, can you take the acid test? And people would go up and take a paper cup and dip it into the Kool-Aid, and that was their trip.
Yeah. And it says all that night first long, night was supposed to...